AUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. 3 weeks after the ousting of Kevin McCarthy, it appeared that Republicans might be on track to getting a new House Speaker, but now it's back to square one tonight. Congressman Tom Emmer dropped out shortly after being nominated by his party. CBS's Nicole Killian reports.
At least 10 to 20 holdouts didn't back him, meaning he likely couldn't survive a vote on the House floor. Some were opposed to his previous vote certifying the 2020 election, while others claimed he was too moderate to be Speaker. Former President Trump also weighed in, calling Emmer a Republican in name only and said electing him would be a tragic mistake.
The health ministry in Gaza says hundreds of people have been killed in the past day as a result of Israeli airstrikes. Israel has been striking Gaza since Hamas militants attacked southern Israeli towns on October 7th. That's when 85-year-old Yosheved Lifshitz was taken. She was one of two Hamas hostages released yesterday. More from CBS's Holly Williams.
Once she was taken to the tunnels, things improved. She said that the people who guarded her said that they would not hurt her. She said that she received medical care and medication and that she ate the same food as her captors. And extraordinarily, in that video we're seeing of the two women as they're released, she actually turns and shakes the hand of one of her captors.
Joseph Emerson, the off-duty pilot who was accused of trying to shut down the engines on a Horizon plane mid-flight, pleads not guilty to state charges of attempted murder and is facing a federal charge. CBS's Chris Van Cleve reports.
About a half hour into the flight, the pilots told investigators Emerson threw off his headset and pulled red fire handles that can cut off fuel to the engines. One of the pilots said he wrestled Emerson away from the controls and asked him to leave the cockpit.
New court documents show that the Alaska Airlines pilot told police he had recently taken psychedelic mushrooms as his mental health worsened. Hurricane Otis quickly grows into a Category 4 storm off Mexico's Pacific coast heading for Acapulco. The U.S. National Hurricane Center warns that Otis could become a Category 5 hurricane before making landfall early tomorrow. In Arlington, Texas. The United Auto Workers Union has expanded its strike to include GM's factory that makes high-margin SUVs, including the Chevy Tahoe and Cadillac Escalade. Some 5,000 workers are now walking the picket line. Women across Iceland, including the prime minister, went on strike today to push for an end to unequal pay and gender-based violence. Schools and shops closed after organizers called on women and non-binary people to refuse paid and unpaid work for 24 hours. This is CBS News.
You need to hire? Indeed is with you every step of the way, helping you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the US Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
You are listening to your local civic media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Know about it.
Doesn't appear to be so.
Well, that's what being a climate denier is all about. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Wednesday, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is going to be in Washington, D.C. for a Center for American Progress event titled Delivering the Goods, the Role of Government. And look, you know, Josh Shapiro, I think, has done a fantastic job of governor in my state of Pennsylvania. When you had that collapse of the I-95 bridge, immediately got to the front of it and did what I thought was an incredibly smart thing, putting it all online so people can see the work being done. In fact, something that I had suggested a long time before that Joe Biden do. In fact, along with the giant 20-foot cardboard cutouts of that stupid thing going, Biden did this, to put at every work site and every project done by the infrastructure bill, also putting it online. In the format of that, him pointing the finger, saying, I did that. But it's going to be interesting to see what Governor Shapiro has to say. Because, look, you know, this was government in action. And I know my right-wing Republican friends are, government can't do anything. Well, they got that bridge open right quick and the economy moving and all of that. And here to share some thoughts on, well, the summit. And what Josh Shapiro did on 90-95, I've asked Kevin DeGood to come talk with us. Kevin is the director of the Inclusive Economy Project there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is the website if you want to take a look at what they do. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, I'm looking at, you know, Governor Shapiro coming to D.C. and, you know, talking about the role of government. This I-95 thing is kind of, in my view, kind of a big deal because I think he did it exactly the way, picture perfect way that we should deal with these kind of crises.
Absolutely. You know, there's no way to plan really in advance for these kinds of freak incidents. And in this case, you had an unforeseeable bridge collapse. But the governor did just an absolutely amazing job and worked in very close partnership with Secretary Pete Buttigieg. They both released emergency funding and a bridge that, you know, most people thought was going to be months and months out of commission, horribly disrupting commuters, the economy. Obviously, everybody knows how critically important I-95 is to the entire Northeast corridor economy. That bridge, at least a temporary structure, was back up within 12 days. And I think that the last time I checked, it looked like the final full replacement bridge was going to be done in 2024, which again is just an incredible testament to how quickly things moved and how everybody pulled in the same direction.
And it's amazing that, you know, we don't hear an awful lot about that because that is government in action. I mean, that is, you know, our government coming together and doing what needs to be done to get things moving. But that's not how we can run all of government. I mean, we should have, you know, ways of making sure that bridges get replaced so they don't collapse. Now, this is not one of those scenarios that caught on fire, gas truck blew up, all that. But, you know, we've seen bridges collapse. We've seen things that should have been replaced that we haven't gotten to. We should be doing better on that front.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, really what I think drove the Biden administration and Congress to pass the infrastructure bill in November of 2021, right? This was a core pledge on the campaign trail in the 2020 election. He said, we've talked about infrastructure for a lot of years. This is something that I promised to deliver on. And they did. And so this is a historic $1.2 trillion investment. The transportation section is enormous. There's $350 billion for highways. There's a full $20 billion of that dedicated just to bridge repair. There's a whole bunch of money in there for EV charging, because we know there's this immensely important transition we need to make with our surface transportation fleet from gas and diesel powered vehicles to clean power, zero emissions vehicles. Let's see, there's $92 billion for transit. There's $66 billion for passenger rail, $25 billion for airports. You know, there's money, there's more than $50 billion for water infrastructure, including the replacement of all lead service lines that are still in the country. It's just an incredible accomplishment. And what we're starting to see here, particularly this year, is those dollars hit the system. And one of the consequences of that major investment is that we have now had a run of unemployment being below 4% for 20 months in a row.
Right.
And that is the longest stretch of time with unemployment below 4% in the last 50 years. It's an incredible accomplishment. It's a testament to Bidenomics and this piece of legislation.
And also, I mean, you know, this is good for the economy in that we're going to be replacing some of the stuff that's probably been around 50, 60, 70 years. And, you know, also the modernization is going to help the economy be more efficient. And the stuff that we should have been doing for decades prior, this is the thing that I get into arguments with people with. You know, we've been living on investments from past generations. This is the first time, at least in my lifetime, that we're making a massive investment in the future and saying, hey, we're going to leave something for my kids when I'm gone. That's worth inheriting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's really the thing to understand. What's so amazing about infrastructure investments is that when you do them right, they pay dividends, not for years, but for decades, for generations. And so we know that the dollars that are in the bipartisan infrastructure law are going to pay dividends for a long time. And right off the bat, what that means is job creation. So in the immediate, we get the benefit of strong middle-class jobs that can support a family, that can allow people to save for retirement, put a child through college. But in the long run, we have this set of very productive assets that are going to help our economy be more productive and more efficient.
Yeah, and what I love to get off of my little rant when you're talking about infrastructure improvements and the jobs that are created with it, a good number of those are union jobs, prevailing wage jobs,
yep.
Done with project labor agreements, which ensures that dollars stay local. They go into the Main Street economy, which helps, you know, the florist and the restaurant owner and the donut shop and all of the, you know, the mom and pops along Main Street. So it not only benefits the people getting those jobs, it benefits the whole local economy where these projects are being built. So, you know, I don't often use that win-win frame, but this is a giant win-win. But I still find it interesting that, and I don't know if it's, you know, the right wing of this country is just against investing or they're just against Biden. But I keep hearing them saying, though, well, this is too much. We can't afford this kind of stuff, which is a bit crazy.
I mean, it is if you consider that our national economic production, our gross domestic product is $25, $26 trillion a year. And this is, you know, $1.2 trillion over 5 years on the bill. And for the transportation section, it's a couple hundred billion. So this is something that's absolutely affordable. And it's affordable not just because of its comparison to our overall GDP, but it's affordable because it's productive, right? Throwing tax cuts at multinational corporations is not particularly productive. Those are expenditures on the balance sheet. Those are things that can add to the budget deficit, but they don't add to our overall productivity, and it doesn't put money in the pocket of working Americans. These infrastructure investments are productive, and they do put money in people's pockets, and they help stimulate hiring for good middle-class jobs. So there's a big difference.
No, I'm with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Kevin DeGood. He's the director of Inclusive Economy at the Center for American Progress. You want to check out their website, americanprogress.org. That's where you go to find their work. Now, you talked about the EV charging stations. You talked about, you know, carbon reduction programs. You talk a lot about climate that's in this. And again, I go back to the opposition who doesn't believe in climate change. So to them, these kind of investments are wasteful, especially when you're talking about EV charging investments, because, you know, the gas and oil industry, they certainly don't seem to want it. What do you say to the person who goes, you know, the free market should decide, Kevin, you know, government shouldn't be putting their thumb on the scale?
Right. It's a good question. It's a fair question. It's important to remember that our tax code is not neutral when it comes to energy, right? I mean, these are energy companies, oil and gas companies are huge economic players. They spend an absolute fortune every year on lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and they have carved up our tax code to their benefit. So it isn't as though when we're looking at clean energy alternatives to the oil and gas industry that somehow it was this magical level playing field before, and now the Biden administration has made it unlevel. No, what we have done is we have thrown money at the oil and gas industry. Whether that's through accelerated depreciation, whether it's through various kinds of write-offs, whether it's through producing the workforce that they take up to use, that people were educated with grants from the federal government to become engineers and things like that. Like we have subsidized this industry for a long time, not to mention that the harms from their core product, which is to say the pollution, the particulate matter, the toxic chemicals, the carbon dioxide emissions, right? All of those have been burned, but none of that cost has been rolled into the cost of the product, right? So we have, in a sense, at a society level, at a global level, we have subsidized and underwritten this industry by not requiring them to account for the harms that the pollution from their product causes. So it's not really accurate to say that somehow it was a level playing field before and now it's not.
Last line of questioning I've got for you, because again, we've heard people say that this is just too much. We can't afford it. You know, we got a $33 trillion debt. I'm sure you've heard about this. I look at this. $1.2 trillion investment in this. Mm-hmm. I've read the American Society of Civil Engineers report that the last time I checked, the last time they came out with a report, and correct me if I'm wrong, they were saying just to get to even, you know, not to grade A, top of the line kind of thing. They're talking $4.8 trillion. So this seems like it's a huge amount. It's a good step, but we're not done.
Right. And the I-95, you know, collapse, it highlights what happens when you don't invest. So I think one of my frustrations when we have this conversation about how much should we spend, how much can we afford, is we don't talk about what the alternative scenario is. And the alternative scenario of underinvestment is when we have systems fail, often catastrophically and very often unpredictably. And the harms from that, both to individuals and also to the economy, are enormous. We can think about the terrible toxic poisoning from lead leaching into drinking water in Michigan a few years back, right? That was because of chronic underinvestment in the water system and making a rash decision to change source waters without appropriate study and without appropriate learning for how to do that, right? So we know that the harms from underinvestment are enormous. So we have to think about this, not just what are we spending, but what problems are we avoiding by making these smart investments?
Yeah, what the alternative to not taking action is. No, I think you're spot on right. Again, I think we need to be doing much more. A huge Biden credit for a huge step forward. But as a country, I think we got to prepare ourselves for much more. But Kevin, I appreciate your thoughts and your expertise. Good stuff.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rick. Happy to be here.
You as well. Kevin DeGood, he is the inclusive economy guy there at the Center for American Progress, americanprogress.org, the website, if you want to take a look at that. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Wow, what a fun day we've had today. It looks like, you know, the very best people, the Trump folks. It looks like, and I hate to make light of this, but it does kind of look like they're flipping like pancakes. I got to tell you, the very best people, they are changing, and they are looking for an exit. And I look at, you know, the folks so far, Mark Meadows, the last chief of staff that Trump had, he's got immunity. So he's going to have to tell the tale of what he saw, heard, keep himself out of the slammer and out of the clink. And then there's Jenna Ellis, who Jenna, you know, I got to tell you, I'm kind of amazed at the argument that she makes. It is quite remarkable, but the argument that she makes, and I want to play the clip of her, you know, doing her little spiel in court today. Here's Jenna Ellis, you know, doing the plea thing.
To aiding and abetting false statements in writings, and under accusation 23 SC190514.
Guilty.
And is this your signature along with Mr. Hogue's signature on the accusation?
It is.
In the wake of the 2020 presidential election, I believed that challenging the results on behalf of President Trump should be pursued in a just and legal way. I endeavored to represent my client to the best of my ability. I relied on others, including lawyers with many more years of experience than I, to provide me with true and reliable information, especially since my role involved speaking to the media and to legislators in various states. What I did not do, but should have done, Your Honor, was to make sure that the facts the other lawyers alleged to be true were in fact true. In the frenetic pace of attempting to raise challenges to the election in several states, including Georgia, I failed to do my due diligence. I believe in and I value election integrity. If I knew then what I know now, I would have declined to represent Donald Trump in these post-election challenges. I look back on this whole experience with deep remorse. For those failures of mine, Your Honor, I have taken responsibility already before the Colorado Bar who censured me, and I now take responsibility before this court and apologize to the people of Georgia.
Wow. If I knew what I knew then, I wouldn't have been Trump's lawyer. And what I find interesting, and I'm going to be called sexist here, and I'm ready for this. Cancel me! Because I'm sure it's coming. This is kind of the, but I'm a girl defense. I was just getting coffee. I didn't know any better. I'm just this isn't my fault. No, this is your fault. And I know she's taking responsibility for it, but with a sweetheart deal. She got the sweetheart deal. And it's amazing how many people in Trump's sphere were just people getting him coffee. I didn't think he drank coffee. I thought everything was Diet Coke. I thought everything was Diet Coke. I didn't realize that Donald Trump drank coffee. Maybe it was for everybody else. Maybe it was for Rudy because he was drunk all the time. I don't know. But it's interesting to see the very best people now coming out and being forgotten by Donald Trump. You know, Sidney Powell, she did some gymnastics. And Trump came out and said, wow, she was never my lawyer. She was just getting me coffee. I find it very interesting that all of these people now, who were the very best people, remember, he only surrounds himself with the very best people. And they all seem to be turning on him. And what I love from right-wing media, because I've been consuming a lot of it lately, is how they're defending their martyr. How they're circling the wagons, the Justice Department, you know, they're biased. They've weaponized law, and the courts are all biased, and the courts are out to get him. No, your guy just messed up. Your guy broke a lot of laws. Guy did a lot of things. And now finally someone is going, we're going to hold you responsible. You know, this whole trying to overthrow the government thing, this is a big freaking deal. And it's the overt acts. And, oh, he was just asking for a recount. If you believe that, I've got bridges for sale. And the ones that don't collapse, ever. It's remarkable to me at how the cult convinces themselves that he was entirely right to bring, you know, thousands of people to Washington, D.C. with the sole intent to stop the certification of the election. That's why they were there. Never forget. That's why they were all called there. We're going to stop the steal, because they all conned their people into believing that the election was rigged. You know, I had a guy email me and say, you're going to want to know this fact, because this fact is really important. It's eye-opening. Did you know that Donald Trump won the in-person vote in every single state in this country? He won the vote. And you go, yeah, he did. He won the vote with people who showed up on that Tuesday. Yeah, he did. That was the scheme from the beginning, because everyone knew that Democrats were voting by mail. Everyone knew that the mass of the vote was going to be done by mail, because the Democratic Party said, hey, don't make yourself sick. Don't get anyone else sick. Vote in a safe fashion by mail. And again, we haven't found the massive frauds that the Sidney Powells and the Rudy Giuliani's and the rest of the kook squad, you know, said we've got the facts, except they never took those facts into a courtroom. And I find it interesting that the right-wing outrage machine conveniently forgets that fact. Now, to the guy's point of Donald Trump won every single state with the in-person vote, he forgets to mention that Joe Biden won every single state with the mail-in vote, because for the first time in ever, I voted by mail. I didn't want to get into what I thought was going to be long lines of you know, people coughing on each other, and then I'd be 6 feet apart, and it just seemed simpler to me. And I love the idea of voting by mail. I love the fact that I don't have to plan to be in a certain place at a certain time on a certain Tuesday to get home from work and quick shower and eat and go, yeah, I don't want to have to do that. I want to go, oh yeah, I'm going to make my choices and I'm going to mail it in, and then they're going to mail me back things that, hey, we got your ballot, it's been counted. This is the thing, again, the right-wing outrage machine doesn't want you to know. In my state, they sent me the ballot, sent me an email to make sure I got it. I sent it back. They sent me an email saying, hey, we got it. We got it. We got your thing. And then when it was counted, they sent me an email, said, hey, just wanted to let you know, it's been counted. And I know. But Rick, you know, you're the exception, not the rule. No, it was the rule. Amazing how well they did this. Amazing how quickly the system worked. And now you're seeing Republicans coming around to the idea of going, hey, we should do mail-in voting. And they're now coming around to promoting mail-in ballots because, you know, they're finally realizing, one, there wasn't the fraud that they're claiming. All of this stuff that Trump spewed, all the stuff that these people who are crying, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't know better, I was just getting coffee, they knew better. And the people who were advising Trump knew better. And we're going to see these lawyers come, sit on the stand, and tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help them, prison. They don't care about God. They don't care about that. They care about prison. And that's what these people are doing. The rats are jumping ship. The rats are finding safe haven, and I'm going to cover my behind. And this is something that a guy who demands loyalty like Trump is going to have a real difficult time with, because Jenna Ellis was close to him. Mark Meadows was his chief of staff, was close to him. I'm waiting for Rudy Giuliani to flip, but I got to be honest. I don't know that anyone's offered him anything, because I think they want to make him an example. And also, I don't think he would take the plea, because probably he's going to need a place to stay after he's done. Because everyone who stands by Trump, broke, screwed. Now, I've had people go, well, do you see any way that Trump gets out of this? I do, actually. I do think that there could be some red hats out there that work their way onto the jury and gum up the system. I do see that possible. And if that is the case, he will be able to play the martyr for another couple of cycles. The scary part here is he could still be president. And I know a lot of my Democratic-leaning friends are like, no, there's no way. Joe Biden's going to win. I don't know. And look, I know a lot of my Democratic friends who they hope that Trump is the candidate because it's probably the only person that Biden can beat. And that's my opinion more than anybody else's. I think Biden would have a much more difficult time with any other Republican. I think the one he can beat is Trump, and I think that's the one he wants. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Got lots to get to. Lots to get to and talk about right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1940. That was the day that the federally mandated 40-hour work week went into effect for U.S. workers. The 40-hour week had been passed as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Making 5 days of 8 hours work the national standard had long been a top goal for labor. For decades, union members organized, demonstrated, went on strike, and even died for the right to work 8 hours. Labor argued that reducing the long, unregulated hours of toil was a matter of workers' health and safety. It was also a matter of dignity. A more reasonable work week would give workers the time to spend with their families, to pursue other interests, and to have a full life outside of the grinding schedule demanded by many bosses. Before the turn of the 20th century, the 8-hour day movement declared 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will as their motto. In 1886, nationwide rallies and strikes for 8 hours took place on May 1st. Today, May Day is celebrated as a workers' holiday around the world in remembrance of that struggle. In 1888, the American Federation of Labor took up the cause, and the Carpenters Union became the standard bearer for the 8-hour day. 10 years later, the United Mine Workers Union members won the 8-hour workday. In 1916, the Adamson Act made 8 hours the standard for interstate railroad workers. A decade after that, Ford Motor Company, a leader in U.S. industry, established the 40-hour work week. Each of these victories were a step along the way to making the 8-hour day a reality and the law of the land. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
There is nothing quite as pitiful as whiny billionaires. And the whiniest of all is the richest, Elon Musk. This self-entitled bully runs over anyone in his way, then whines when they protest. Elon's latest high-pitched screech was prompted by public demands that his profiteering schemes obey clean water and safety regulations. He owns a corporation named, believe it or not, the Boring Company, an underground tunneling venture based in Bastrop, Texas, digging out tons of soil chemicals and contaminated groundwater. But where to put all the waste? I'll just dump the stuff in the nearby Colorado River, said Lord Musk. Lots of stuff, 140,000 gallons of wastewater per day. But that river is our main water source, said local people. You'll need to comply with water treatment and disposal rules. Outrageous, whined Elon, maniacally squealing that construction is becoming practically illegal in America. So he proceeded to dump his waste without a permit. Then he encountered Chap Ambrose, a boring neighbor and former Musk admirer. Chap began asking questions and getting nothing but evasions, lies, and disrespect. Musk was messing with Texas, so Ambrose rallied local opposition through a website he named Keep Bastrop Boring. With a drone, he videoed Musk's expanding industrial mess, broadcasting the videos throughout the area. He filed actions with county, state, and national regulatory authorities and got his state senator to hold a hearing attended by hundreds of residents in this rural county. Musk can bamboozle powerful officials, but not feisty people like Chap, who recently ridiculed the pouty billionaire. Development remains legal in Bastrop, Ambrose told him, but what is illegal is polluting Texas water. You're making this way harder than it has to be. This is Jim Hightower saying the fight goes on, and I'm betting on Chapp.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, federal agents found more than two dozen miners, not coal miners, but miners, kids, illegally working in a poultry plant in Kidron, Ohio. And are you surprised by that? No, because we've talked about the story that the poultry industry, the packing industry, probably wouldn't be as profitable without as many kids working in them doing dangerous jobs. And again, this is another one of those moments where we're finally starting to pay attention to the horrible that is child labor and our return to the good old days. You know, when we got those kids back in the mines, got them back in the looms, got them back doing factory work. They got little hands. They can do intricate work. At least one party believes that, and it, as we've been saying, is the Republican Party. And here to share some thoughts on his most recent piece, GOP, when did you become the pro-child labor party? Written by Timothy Noah. He is a staff writer over at The New Republic. Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me. I always enjoy doing your show.
So, you know, we've been seeing these stories popping up, child labor violations on the rise. We've been seeing a whole bunch of this stuff, but it's really the Republicans who are trying to normalize and legalize what has been and hopefully will remain illegal acts.
Yeah, I mean, this is an actual vulnerability by in Joe Biden's administration, is that child labor violations keep rising and rising and rising. And the Republicans don't want to hit him for it. It's really weird. And but the reason they don't want to hit him for it is because they're in favor of child labor. They want more of it. They want to deregulate it. They don't especially mind that we're seeing a huge increase in child labor. We saw an increase 6 months ago. We saw another increase we learned about last week in the previous fiscal year.
No, it's amazing to me. But here's the thing. It's not new, Tim. I remember Newt Gingrich running for president a whole bunch of years ago and going, hey, we get rid of those union janitors. We put those kids to work cleaning the bathrooms. We can save a bunch of money and teach those poor kids a little work ethic, help them pull themselves up by the bootstraps.
What's different is it in those days, it was understood to be something crazy that Republicans said every now and then. Now it's gone completely mainstream. You've got states passing laws deregulating child labor, and you've got laws cropping up in Congress, proposed laws introduced by Republicans. You've also got Democrats proposing all sorts of laws intended to, try and get our arms around this problem and address it. And very few Republicans are willing to sign on to that. There's a child labor, I forget what it's called, basically a child labor caucus, and there aren't any Republicans who want to join it.
Hey, but here's the thing, Tim. Why do we need a child labor caucus? This is the 21st century. I thought we got out of 19th century thinking.
I know. I mean, it's really bizarre. And you know, it was about 100 years ago, a little longer, when this first became an issue at the national level. And then during the New Deal, we passed the Fair Labor Standards Act,
right,
which imposed some strict regulations. And these are the regulations that we're finding violations of left and right. And Congress won't give the Labor Department enough money to enforce the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Now, we can pass laws, but there are no teeth in the enforcement. What does it matter? Now, here's the thing that I've been saying, and I don't know if you'll agree or disagree. But I've been saying, look, you know, the Republicans, they're the party of cheap labor. They're the party of big business. They need to get cheap labor into the workforce and to do some of these dangerous jobs that a lot of people have, you know, a lot of Americans don't want to do. And, you know, the children that are working in these meatpacking plants, on these farms, in these tobacco plants, these aren't kids that look like mine. These are poor immigrant kids. These are poor minority kids. You know, people that, you know, this is giving them a pathway to the American dream. But it's not going to be people like my kids that are going to suffer under this. And I think that's why it's been so tolerated and why it's palatable to a lot of Republican voters.
Right. They're not like us. I mean, what's happened is the arrival of unaccompanied minors into the United States, combined with a tight labor market, has just made child labor way too tempting for slaughterhouses, for chicken processors, all kinds of factories that are fully aware of the fact that they're breaking the law when they put these kids in these positions, and they expect to get away with it. There was the New York Times, there's a wonderful reporter at the New York Times who I think should win a Pulitzer for the really magnificent reporting she's produced over the past few months on this problem. She wrote about a slaughterhouse in Virginia where, you know, there was this kid from Guatemala
who lost an arm.
Well, he didn't lose it, but it got mangled in a machine.
Yeah.
And by law, the plant has to call that in to the regulator. And in Virginia, they have a Virginia OSHA. So you call it into the Virginia OSHA. And the regulator in Virginia said, well, you guys, why don't you guys just do a self-inspection on this one and let me know.
And that's how this problem gets swept under the rug. And look, I would argue it's probably because they don't have the people to come out and do it.
Is that nobody ever asked, how old was this kid?
Right.
Like, first question you ask.
Well, because I got to think that, you know, they're thinking that, you know, the companies are going to police themselves. They don't want to be exposed to, you know, the fines and all kinds of stuff, even though the fines, we both know, are pathetically low. If you pass laws that said, hey, if you hire a child that gets killed on the job or maimed or injured, the CEO goes to jail, I guarantee you there are no more kids getting hired into these dangerous jobs.
That's right. That's right. And the other way the reputational hit is managed is through what David Weil, who was the who ran the wage and hour division under Obama and was nominated to run it again and couldn't get confirmed in the Senate, which was a whole other disgrace because he's a good man. But anyway, Weil wrote a book about called The Fissured Workplace, where he talked about how the way it works now is if you have a name brand company like Purdue and they have a factory, a chicken slaughterhouse, they don't want to hire the people who go work there. They give that job to a contractor,
right,
that nobody's ever heard of. So when the contractor gets nailed, there's no particular reputational loss to the contractor. The contractor's small, doesn't have a reputation.
They file bankruptcy tomorrow. They change their name. They start all over again.
And Purdue, meanwhile, says, we had no idea. We were appalled. Of course, how do you get that contract from Purdue with the low bid?
Right. And this is where, again, I come back to the idea that if we're going to reunite this country, we've got to reunionize. If we're going to keep children safe, we got to reunionize this country. Now, look, I'm not against kids working in jobs that do teach them, about the value of a dollar. And, you know, my kids have been working since they were 15. My son's been a lifeguard. My daughter worked, you know, as a hostess at a restaurant. There were jobs that teach them, you know, how to show up on time, how to be, you know, a good, you know, diligent worker, how to save. And there are good things, good qualities to work that we want to encourage. I don't know about, you know, working in a meatpacking plant, working in a sawmill, you know, in some
working
of these
overnight.
Construction
plants. I mean, what's a kid doing working overnight? He's supposed to be in school the next day.
Exactly.
It's obviously it's not the fact that kids work, but it's the fact that the Republicans want kids to work in more dangerous jobs. They want kids to be working longer hours. They want kids to be working nighttime hours. I mean, it's absurd. You know, there have been all these laws that have been passed at the state level, and most of them are really appalling. You know, there's one that I don't especially object to, which is in New Jersey, they wanted to lengthen the number of hours, allowable work hours during the summer vacation. you know, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
You know, but most of these laws are really, I think, a threat to health and safety.
Well, what it's doing is it's the Republican mantra of the corporations will act in their best interest. So they'll police themselves, Timothy. You know, they're not going to do anything to, like, as you pointed out, damage their brand. No, no,
right.
they're good corporate citizens, and they're going to do what's right. And we know time after time after time after time that they don't. They do what's in their best interest. Their best interest are the bottom line and the profits that they put in their pocket. Kids be damned, workers be damned, rules be damned. It's all about the buck.
And they also, but they've also added this new trick that Weil talks about, where they avoid accountability through contracting out, you know, as much low wage labor.
And also, it makes it that much harder to unionize, because you just don't use that contractor anymore.
Right.
And it's another way to get around that, which is why, again, we need a major overhaul of our labor laws to address these kind of things that corporate America has put into place.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure out these ruses, but you do need an alert government to follow these developments and protect workers.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Timothy Noe. He's a staff writer over at the New Republic. If you want to check out his piece, GOP, when did you become the pro-labor party? We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. But you know, here's the thing, and this is where I want to kind of wrap this into. You know, I had a friend who's a state legislator out in Iowa. You know, he goes to a construction site and there are kids working on the construction site. I mean, it's become, you know, so prevalent now that you know, you can stumble on it in a lot of places. What's it going to take for parents like me, for people who don't want to see children exploited? And what's it going to take for us to stop this ball that's funded by the Coke machine, that's funded by big money? What's it going to take for us to stop it?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, this really is the kind of thing that I thought would never come back. I really thought those were the bad old days and they're gone forever. I was taught that in school. And they are coming back and no one seems to care.
Yeah.
I think, you know, sort of publicizing it has to become a big story. And again, I applaud the New York Times for dedicating the resources it has, but it, you know, it can't just be the New York Times. It's got to be everybody, because it's happening everywhere.
No, and it's why we've talked about it so much here on the program. And I look at Iowa. Iowa had one of the most, what I think, one of the most egregious clauses in their basically repeal of their child labor law, to where you're going to turn work into an apprenticeship program, and the companies aren't liable for anything that happens to the kids while they're on this apprenticeship program. And so basically nobody's, if a kid gets hurt, maimed, killed, whatever, basically nobody's accountable, and the kid's just out of luck. And you go, how is that sane? How is that rational? But right. You know, you've got crazy people running Iowa.
Right. And you know, you also hear a lot of pious talk by Republicans about how this shouldn't be entirely up to the parents. And you know, that really is what they said 100 years ago.
Yep.
I mean, it should really be up to the parents, and the reformers said no, it shouldn't be entirely up to the parents, because a lot of parents are sending their kids out to work
because they don't have a choice. I mean, this is, again, I come back to, we've got poverty in this country where people are desperate. Look, if everybody had a living wage job and everybody, you know, was somewhere in the same world financially, fine, parents can make, I can make decisions for my kids, and I believe I will make the right ones, because our lives aren't dependent on them bringing money home to keep a roof over our head or food on the table. But when that's the reality of a family where they need that third or fourth income, that's a problem.
Right, right. That's why you need to bring in another actor. You do need to bring in the state to look out after the interests of the child. The common law of 100 years ago, it's really interesting, was sort of based on some, you know, English constitutional law that basically said a child is the possession of the father. A child was like a mule or an enslaved person. I mean, it was unbelievable. And the law has progressed quite a lot since then. And there's some risk that we're now returning to that grotesque standard.
It is crazy times. And again, as I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. That is the sad reality. But Timothy, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great piece. Hope people will take a look at it. GOP, when did you become the party? The pro-labor, or the pro-child labor party, written by Timothy Noah. He's a staff writer over at the New Republic. Timothy, I appreciate the time, man. Great stuff.
Thank you, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that the first minimum wage law went into effect in the United States. The first minimum wage was 25 cents an hour. The wage law was part of the Fair Labor Standards Act passed earlier that year. The act also included a mandate for a 40-hour work week and restrictions against child labor. Raising the minimum wage is one of the great political battles being fought by labor today. Since 1968, the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation. It has lost one-third of its value. Not coincidentally, the top 1% of the wealthiest people in the United States have seen their share of the nation's economy double, from 11% in 1968 to 22% in 2012. In January of 2014, 600 leading economists, including seven Nobel Peace Prize winners, wrote an open letter to Congress and the President. They urged for the passage of an increase in the minimum wage. The letter explained, "In recent years, there have been important developments in the academic literature on the effect of increases in the minimum wage on employment. With the weight of evidence now showing that increases in the minimum wage have little or no effect on the employment of minimum wage workers, even during times of weakness in the labor market, research suggests that a minimum wage increase could have a small stimulative effect on the economy as low-wage workers spend their additional earnings, raising demand and job growth, and providing some help on the jobs front." The 1938 minimum wage law was passed at the height of the Great Depression. Labor was on the march for economic justice and fair working conditions. What will it take today to get our elected officials to raise the wage? Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Remember, if you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Always there, always available. And look, subscribe to the podcast. We want to make sure that when we, on December 1st, when we leave radio, and this could be short term, could be long term. We don't know yet. There's some things in the works that I'm excited about. The future going to be very bright, I think. And look, I've gotten a lot of response, and thank you. I'm feeling the love. And I appreciate that of the folks saying, you know, sad to see you go. But, you know, this is one of those positive moves that I think is going to give us the ability to really target on the stuff that we want to work on, going to free us up from, you know, being locked to a studio, get us out and talking to people and do some projects that I'm really excited about. You know, there's some real optimism here about this move, and we're working with various stations to, you know, to simulcast the TV show, and if there's some interest in that, we're looking forward. So we're not going to go away entirely. You'll still be stuck listening to us on some level, and I know that makes some people very happy, and well, some very sad, and well, tough on you. But no, this is a good thing, but like I said, I appreciate everyone reaching out. And you know, I got a lot of, you know, hey, are you okay? And yeah, I'm fine. I'm great. This is going to be a good thing. Going to help us, like I said, get out of the studio a little bit. I've got lots of, next summer looks like what we're planning, an excellent opportunity to get out and really get our hands dirty. And then bring back some great content. But if you don't follow Free Speech TV, that's where we're heading. Freespeech.org is the website. It's in, you know, I think they're saying 65, 70 million homes across the country. If you don't have if your cable provider doesn't get it, it's streamed virtually everywhere. So it's literally in every home in the country. This gives us the opportunity to really expand our reach and to organize you know, as an organizer at heart, this is an incredible tool to help us reach into people's homes and grab them and say, hey, it's time to reunite this country. It's time to bring us together. It's time to reunionize this country. It's time to share the pie a little bit more equally. And it's about making lives better. So I'm really excited. But again, thank you to everyone who has sent well wishes and good thoughts. I'm happy. And look, I think it's a testament to the 18 years that we've been here on the radio and the relationships that we've built over the years. And look, we're not going away. I hope everyone who emails us will continue. I hope the conversations continue because it's really, really good stuff that I think is coming along down the pike. But here's the thing, and this is where I think the show, the kind of show that we do and what we want to be doing is going to bring people in. Because look, you know, the latest Pew Research poll out said that in 2016, 51% of U.S. adults said that they followed the news all or most of the time. That number has fallen down to 38%. That means things are, you know, people are staying away from, you know, the corporate media. They're looking for other alternative and other sources. And I want us to be part of that. So we're going to be putting out the TV show, a daily podcast, specifically for podcasts. Quick in. We're looking at doing like a 10-minute. Here's the top stories of the day. Quick in and out. Helps you get the basic stuff you need. And then a 30-minute, you know, whatever it is that I'm working on that day. And plus the TV show, that'll give you an opportunity to stay engaged, stay active with the program, and for us to interact. And I think that's going to be fabulous. I want to finish up with one story that has me particularly upset. Comes out of Virginia. The Republican Party of Virginia evidently mailed out thousands of explicit flyers about this Suzanne Gibson. You may know about Suzanne Gibson's story. Her and her husband were engaging in marital discourse online for money, had followers, had, you know, people directing. There's a lot of that's evidently the new thing. She's being shamed for this. What I find interesting is the very people who say you should get married and, you know, stay married and, you know, raise the kids and, you know, family matters. And I find it interesting that they're the ones pointing their finger going, well, that's bad. Hey, they're staying together at a time when marriages are breaking up at an alarming rate and people are running away from it. Republicans should be grabbing onto this. In fact, most of the guys should be going, hey, how do you keep that going? Maybe we get a channel that nobody's going to watch. But evidently they sent out this flyer with lots of very coarse language and this woman's picture and all kinds of stuff. And in an envelope that says, you know, don't open if you're under the age of 18, explicit material enclosed. And I got to tell you, the first thought that I had, you know, and it's been a long time since I've been under 18. I remember going, if someone said don't, I would say, oh yeah, there's no way that I'm not. And, you know, I'm smart enough and always was smart enough to be able to open that stuff without anybody ever knowing. Because I'm good like that. In fact, you know, my kids, you know, all the years that they were losing teeth and the tooth fairy would come and bring them money. Because what my wife used to do is have them color a, you know, an envelope and, you know, put a note in the envelope with the tooth. And then they would lick it and seal the envelope closed. And, you know, we would get it and open the envelope and put the money in, take the tooth. And they never knew how you could get into the sealed envelope. Well, all you need is a teapot. So anyone with a teapot could be looking at the explicit material that I, as a 13-year-old, would have certainly opened without question because, well, that was me. And I think any 13-year-old, especially a 13-year-old boy, if you say do not, they will absolutely. So, but this is what they sent out. They sent all this stuff out, and it's really kind of nasty. In fact, this is the weird part. In fact, when the news station went to a Republican event, a lot of Republicans were actually uncomfortable with it. So there's hope. There's possible hope here that maybe we found the bounds of too far. Now, will these Republicans who found the bounds too far, will they hold the Republican candidate responsible for this? who knows? We'll see. The election's just a couple of days away. But this is a race that I'm going to keep an eye on. It's a House seat in Virginia. Will be interesting. But there's no depths that they won't go to. There's no decency level anymore. And remember, Republicans tell us they're the party of family values. Explain to me again how sending illicit pictures to people's homes via the mail is, you know, the.
You're listening to The Shah.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.